start off. This is the second session on the topic, the concept of evil. And I'd like, first of all, this morning, just to briefly review what happened on Tuesday, for those of you who weren't here, and then elaborate a couple of things that happened, and then go on to a further topic for about 20, 25 minutes or so, and then open it up for discussion. Now, the method of this discussion was to focus on the meaning of certain moral terms, like good and evil, right and wrong, and so on. And a lot of people have a lot of problem with words, symbols, whatever you want to call them, feeling that somehow this might stand between them and the reality that they're trying to get at. And I thought, just to illustrate some of the difficulties that can happen, I'd read a couple of passages from a rather charming book, namely Lewis Carroll's Alice in Wonderland and Through the Looking Glass, which is a very subtle book as far as the meanings of language are concerned. And you can see perhaps some of the difficulty, and he illustrates them in a very carefree and happy way, but problems really do arise here. But anyway, just a couple of passages. Alice at one point runs into a king, the white king, I guess it is, and he had just sent some messengers along the road, and he says, "Just look along the road and tell me if you can see either of them." "I see nobody on the road," said Alice. "I only wish I had such eyes," the king remarked in a fretful tone. "To be able to see nobody, and at that distance, too. Why, it's as much as I can do to see real people by this light." All this was lost on Alice, who was still looking intently along the road, shading her eyes with one hand. "I see somebody now," she exclaimed at last, and so on and so forth. And then the messenger comes up and is feeding the king, and the messenger runs out of sandwiches and has some hay. And so the king takes some hay, and then Alice says, the king says to Alice, "There's nothing like eating hay when you're faint," he remarked to her as he munched away. "I should think throwing cold water over you would be better," Alice suggested. "I didn't say there was nothing better," the king replied. "I said there was nothing like it," which Alice did not venture to deny. "Who did you pass on the road?" the king went on, holding out his hand to the messenger for some hay. "Nobody," said the messenger. "Quite right," said the king. "This young lady saw him too. So, of course, nobody walks slower than you." "I do my best," the messenger said in a sullen tone. "I'm sure nobody walks much faster than I do." "He can't do that," said the king, "or else he'd have been here first. However, now you've got your breath, you may tell us what's happening in town." Now, this obviously is just a spoof in Carroll's very good style, but there's a sense in which a lot of serious misunderstanding is contained in here. I mean, there's a sense in which this is exactly the type of thing that certain contemporary philosophers are doing when they start going on talking about being and nothingness, or when they try to somehow turn the word nothing into some type of a substantive phrase. Now, Carroll, of course, spoofs it very well, but the danger is still there. Now, just one other quick phrase about the use of words. Much later on in her wanderings in this looking glass world, Alice bumps into a white knight who is a very comical figure. And he again puts her on, so to speak, by means of playing with language. The knight, looking at her, said, "You're very sad. Let me sing you a song to comfort you." "Is it very long?" Alice asked, for she had heard a good deal of poetry that day. "It's long," said the knight, "but it's very, very beautiful. Everybody that hears me sing it, either it brings the tears into their eyes, or else what?" said Alice, for the knight had made a sudden pause. "Or else it doesn't, you know. The name of the song is called Haddock's Eyes." "Oh, that's the name of the song, is it?" Alice said, trying to feel interested. "No, you don't understand," the knight said, looking a little vexed. "That's what the name is called." Now, right there becomes a very important distinction, at least for a lot of contemporary so-called analytic philosophy, the way in which various symbols can be applied to other things, that words themselves can have, or whole complexes of words, like sentences and titles, can have names, if you wish. So he says, "You don't understand. That's what the name is called. The name really is the aged man." "Then I ought to have said, that's what the song is called," Alice corrected herself. "No, you oughtn't. That's quite another thing," the knight said. "The song is called Ways and Means. But that's only what it's called, you know." "Well, what is the song then?" said Alice, who was by this time completely bewildered. "I was coming to that," the knight said. "The song really is a sitting on a gate, and the tune's my own invention." So saying, he stopped his horse and let the reins fall on its neck, then slowly beating time with one hand and with a faint smile lighting up his gentle, foolish face, As if he enjoyed the music of his song, he began, and so on. Now, the important distinction, again, portrayed by this elaborate put-on, where you've got, and if you try to diagram what's going on, you've really got four different expressions, at least, referring to different kinds of entities. You've got the name of the title, and then you've got the title, and then you've got the what the poem is called, and then you've got what the poem is, so to speak. This points out the very complexity of language and how it relates not only to non-linguistic entities, like we might use the letter C-H-A-I-R to refer to the object that we're sitting in, but also how words can be used to refer to themselves, or language can be used to refer to itself, because words seem to be objects among other objects, particularly if you treat them somehow physically or as functions of behavior. I mean, words can be interpreted either as marks on paper or sounds in the air, and those certainly are just as much objects as chairs or fireplaces, windows, and so on. And so it's discussions of that sort that have caused many contemporary philosophers to begin their discussion of substantive topics by an examination of the language used to get at those topics, because the language itself is a discussable topic. Now, what we did last time was to look briefly at one interpretation of the concept of evil, or of moral terms in general, really, of good and evil, or right and wrong, which insisted that words had to refer to something in the world of our experience in order to have any meaning, and that if they didn't, they were literally meaningless. They just were expressed our emotion, something like the cheerleader's hurrah, but that they didn't literally say anything meaningful, whereas words that can be, so to speak, pinned onto, and that obviously is highly metaphorical, but words that can be attached somehow to objects of our experience, words like hard and soft, red and green, square and round, chair, stone, wood, these words are quite meaningful, because there's something that we can get at. And even words that appear to get at supposedly intangible features like love, brotherhood, and so on, still are getting at features of our experience. Or to put it in another way, there are ways of verifying or falsifying sentences like my children hate me, or my wife loves me, or something of that sort. We know what it would be to find out whether or not that sentence is true. Now, the real question that this gives rise to then is whether we can talk about ethical language, ethical sentences, as really being either true or false. Because as I pointed out last time, it would be really bizarre to ask the cheerleader, when she was using words like yay and hurrah and so on, whether or not what she had just expressed was true. In the sense in which we would talk about a sentence like there's a fire in Koinonia this morning as being either true or false. And the source of this problem, as Henry, among others, pointed out last time, is that we try to look for a common frame of reference, or at least some people are looking for this. This was the initial problem with which I began. Whether or not there might be some common frame of reference in which we could settle various moral disputes. Now, in the, quote, scientific realm, unquote, whether you're talking about the natural sciences or even the behavioral sciences, there do seem to be ways of settling disputes, or to put it another way, these people seem to live in a common world. And any scientist, biologist or botanist or something, who wants to get on as a scientist has to take seriously the findings and results and methods of other people who consider themselves biologists. He can't just go off all on his own. Or again, we seem to have certain rules of thinking, roughly called logic, which we pretty much all agree upon again. And very seldom, if at all, does anybody go off on his own and just say, well, I'm using, you know, Johnsonian logic or something, and you other people who happen to think in your traditional patterns, just leave me alone because I've got my own style here and it's my own world, and I'll figure it out for myself. But when we get to values, the 20th century seems to very vigorously deny that there is any sort of common framework. Whether you're talking really about ethical values or even aesthetic values. In the area of art, you get the same question all over again with the use of various words, like even the word art itself, but whether or not something is beautiful or so on. And also the criteria according to which you'd call something art. So that the school of philosophy we looked at last time wanted to say that ethical terms really don't have any meaning in the way in which what we might call empirical or factual terms do. In that sense, they're meaningless. And they serve a function, perhaps, namely of venting our emotions and of trying to evoke the same emotion in somebody else, much like the cheerleader's hurrah definitely serves a function. I mean, it's not pointless. There's a definite point to what that cheerleader is doing. It's just that that particular utterance doesn't come under the categories true and false. Now, one example that I had used last time that I want to build on this time was a very simple one in distinguishing between the two sentences, "This apple is red," which would seem to refer to a separate feature or a designated feature of our common world. And we can figure it out either sort of intuitively, just taking a look, and if we have pretty normal vision, deciding that it's red, or if we want to go to an elaborate optical laboratory and set up all sorts of equipment to find out the length of the light waves being transmitted by that surface, we can again say that this is transmitting light waves that scientists normally call red and so on. But when we come to the sentence, "This apple is good," the question was raised as to whether or not we are talking about the apple, or whether in that case we have something like, "This is an apple and I like this." And the man who says, "This is a bad apple," is saying, "This is an apple and I detest this." And that if that's what they're doing, it's like two people who are handed, say, a bottle of 7-Up, and they each take a sip, they just come back from a hike, say, and they're asked whether or not 7-Up is refreshing. Now, if one says yes and one says no, it would seem that at that point we really don't have a legitimate dispute on our hands, because we're really not talking about the 7-Up, we're talking about the way in which the 7-Up affects them, or whether or not they like it, and so on. Now, in contrast to this, and this is where I'd like to move off onto a little different topic today then, in contrast to this, consider the following sort of parable, perhaps, dealing with the apple. Suppose there's a man who detests apples, but is in dire need of a job, and he goes out to an orchard and gets a job sorting apples for the orchard grower. Excuse me, between those that are to be shipped off to market and those that are to be made in. Excuse me, did I drink here?
I'll get one for you.
Now, it's conceivable that this man would go throughout the whole day as he's sorting apples that are brought in by the pickers, using phrases, well, he probably wouldn't do it verbally, but we have to construct it that way, using phrases like, "This is a good apple, this is not a good apple," and maybe he's got a whole series of categories of apples, I mean, eating apples, baking apples, cooking apples, cider apples, and so on. It's at least imaginable that he could say both of two things. On the one hand, "This is a good apple," and "I detest apples." Whereas on the view we considered last time, that would appear to be a rule out, would appear to be a contradiction. That if that the phrase, "This is a good apple," would be meaningless to him if he detests apples. But it does seem plausible that in this context, at least, of sorting the apples in the orchard, that the man could say both of these things simultaneously. This is a good apple, and I detest, apples. Now, this also, I suppose, reminds us of the automobile case I mentioned last time, too. But what exactly, or on what basis, does that man make this value judgment? And if you start checking around, you'll find out that he makes that judgment on the basis of a set of criteria. Probably, since he detests apples, it would be a set of criteria that the orchard owner had supplied him. And if it's a certain size, and if it's red and round and juicy and firm and so on, that's what we mean by a good apple. Now, obviously, if we start asking what these criteria are for, we have to admit that these are not criteria for goodness, pure and simple. Or if you want to speak in more rigorous language, this does not provide us with a definition of the word good. At best, what we get is a definition of the phrase good apple. For example, these criteria will not help you sort bananas. So if you were to say this is a good banana and this is not a good banana, you'd have a completely, or at least somewhat different list of criteria on hand, yet you'd be using the same word, good in one case and good in the other case. So that the criteria themselves do not give us a definition of good in isolation, but rather good here is being defined in a certain context, either in the apple context or the banana context or the car context, or where it becomes pressing for us in the man context, what it really is to be a human being, or to be a good human being, a moral human being. Now, the point that this starts to raise is perhaps that the notions of goodness and of evil lack meaning in isolation. In other words, as we commonly use them in orchard situations and so on, we use them in a highly developed context in terms of human interests, in terms of industries that have been set up and needs that have been institutionalized and so on. And that the word only carries its meaning because of this elaborate context. For instance, I mean, the Oxford English Dictionary defines the word good not in terms of any specific characteristic in the world that people can apprehend, but all it says is that this is the most general adjective or something of that sort of, or most general term of commendation in the English language. And all that does, in other words, is give you a certain, tell you about a certain function. It doesn't tell you at all about any entity or property to which this word refers. And of course, that was the idea, that the word good referred to a quality out there in the world, was sort of the assumption on which we were operating last time. I mean, look at the example. The apple is red as opposed to the apple is good. We tried to see whether or not there was a parallel between the two, assuming, of course, that the word red already got at some quality or property or characteristic of the apple. So, if we are looking for some sort of common framework, at least that transcends the limit of one individual human being, perhaps we have to move in this direction, namely in terms of giving a list of criteria of how we choose to use words like good or bad. Now, here you might, let's just take another example, since I've already used Alice and we've had the word king crop up. Consider the definition of the word king in chess. If you're acquainted with chess, at least. What it is to be a king in a game of chess has nothing to do with any particular perceivable or experienceable qualities. The king does not have to be 5 inches high. The king does not have to be made out of ivory. The king does not have to weigh 3 pounds. In other words, the piece that we call king in chess, in the game of chess, can have almost any set of, or probably could have literally any set of physical characteristics that we wish, as long as it's movable. I mean, there are people who even play chess on large tile floors using people as the movers. So that what it is to be a king, if we're talking here about some type of being, is determined entirely by the context or by the function, by the way in which this object works, the way in which it moves around, if you wish, in the game. I mean, the king moves in a quite different way from the way in which the pawns move or the knights move and so on and so forth. And it's these movements, this functioning in the game, that determine what it is to be a king. Now, we, for very definite reasons, namely communication, tend to highly abbreviate and thereby make highly ambiguous our everyday language. I mean, the same four letters, K-I-N-G, crop up in other contexts, like King of Britain or King of England. Now here, of course, we're using the same letters, pronounced in the same way, and so on. But obviously, the function of anyone who would be designated King of England is quite different from the function of that entity designated as the White King in a game of chess. Similarly, it could be that the meaning of the word good shifts as radically from a context like good apple to a context like good man. And that the only thing that is, the only thing that remains the same is either just the same four letters, G-O-O-D, or the same very general but highly vague function that the dictionary told us about, namely commending. But that otherwise, all the criteria in terms of which we talk have shifted. The context has shifted radically. I mean, you don't talk about good man in terms of red or round or so on. Now this view, as I said before, has the virtue of transcending the limitations of the individual. I mean, insofar as we started looking for a common framework, it would seem that here we can find it, namely in conventionally established contexts where people have set up certain rules, like in a game of chess. I mean, here's a context where you can get Swedish and American and Russian and Chinese and so on, chess players together, and they can all exist in the same context. They can all understand the rules and understand, at least if they know English, what the word king means in that context and what the word check means in that context and so on. And similarly, in our world at large, both those who desire and those who detest apples can still agree on what it is to be a good apple. But the difficulty with this problem, I suppose, if you want to call it a difficulty, at least one feature of this problem, and that feature becomes a difficulty viewed from our initial question of whether or not there's any common framework that all people could get into. The difficulty is that this view limits value judgments to those contexts in which the criteria are offered. In other words, if we take this very general phrase now, good man, or proper man, or something of that sort, everybody who agrees on that, on a given definition of that, could probably make analogous value judgments in certain circumstances. I mean, for example, it seems to me that all the members of a tribe of New Guinea headhunters may be able to agree on criteria for the meaning of the phrase good man in English. And similarly, all Pennsylvania Quakers could agree among themselves as to criteria for what it is to be a good man. But it seems that the Pennsylvania Quakers might very radically disagree with the set of criteria offered by the New Guinea headhunters, particularly in terms of taking lives. You know, the good man for the Quaker, or the best man, is not the one who is most skillful at capturing the head of an enemy. Now this, of course, pushes the question back a further step, and I don't know if it's even possible to go beyond that step, or if one just has, again, as Henry said last time, to sort of agree to disagree, if you can get the headhunters to do that. But I suppose the only question I would raise here at the end and then open it up for discussion is whether or not this common framework is possible, because we do, at least in some contexts, seem to have a common language, at least if we're careful about it. I mean, as I said before, we abbreviate quite a lot in order to communicate. I mean, if you think about what is really meant by, or what the definition is of the word chair, you realize that quite a lot is contained. I mean, or again, if you think of the definition of the word deer, particularly as a biologist might provide it in elaborate detail, you realize that it, for purpose of communication, it's a lot easier, for example, for Larry to point up there and say, look at the deer behind Chalet 3, than to say, look at the, and then stop and insert a long biologist definition, and then say, behind the chalet. I mean, if we were to try to be that explicit and precise and clear in everything we said, we'd never get anything said. I mean, it would take Larry half the morning, perhaps, to tell you, and by that time, of course, the deer would have disappeared and you'd never see it, and so on. So that for purpose of communication, we have to abbreviate. And so we have to be careful about what abbreviations or what definitions have crept into in these little four-letter words like deer and good and so on. And it's at that point, I suppose, that most of our discussion, at least in relation to language, has to take place. I mean, we have to come to grips with or come to understand the criteria that somebody else is using when he uses the word good in a context like good man or good apple or fast horse or something of that sort. But if we are careful, as I started to say, it seems we do have a common language. I mean, when I say to somebody else who knows English, shut the door, he can understand what is meant. Or if I say bring a chair or look at the deer or something. And the underlying question, at least for philosophers, is if we grant that we have a common language, how is it possible? What makes it possible that we do have this common language? And the most pervasive answer that seems to be given is that we somehow have a common world, the thing I started the hour with. There's a certain set of objects, call it reality if you want, or the world, or the universe, or whatever, with which we are somehow all in contact to some degree or other, and which we can use this language to get at. Now the ethical question then is whether or not there are any values that are also part of that world, namely the world that somehow transcends just an individual and his desires or his interests and so on.
So it's clear in my mind is that we're saying that as far as the physical world is concerned, it creates language. I mean, there are deer and there are apples, right? And chairs, and we make up words, sounds that we attach to those, and then that's a convenient shorthand, eh?
Yeah.
But that we're not certain yet that the moral world has any objective realities or any object in it that
right.
We can attribute the more, for us, indefinite words like good and bad or lovely or ugly to, right?
So right. That whether or not there are, if you want to put it this way, any moral facts or something like that.
Yeah, that's right. Whether there are any objective moral realities that would warrant our saying that everybody knows really what good means when we say the word good.
Or even if you want, that there are any subjective ones. I mean, I suppose the really three options are either that these words refer to something outside of people, or that they refer to something subjective, or that they don't refer to anything. Maybe they're meaningless, which is the option I can
say. How does this come
from the fact that there are some languages that don't have words for things that we have that
know
what
the
competition? Are they asking those who have 8 or 9 words for snow or
something?
Yeah.
Well,
I suppose
that
would.
Is that
well, this, but the, okay, let me, you know, this view, though, doesn't claim to achieve universality outside, I mean, how should I put it, universality in the sense of the whole human race. It only talks about universality within the limits of a group of people who agree on certain linguistic conventions, certain rules, just like chess players agree on certain rules for playing a game of chess. So at least some people who speak English agree on certain rules for speaking the language. And I suppose one would, if you were giving a sort of functional analysis of these words, you would have to say that the 8 or 9 words for snow in the Eskimos language serve definite functions. I mean, you can even give it a sort of Darwinian twist, I suppose. I mean, these words enable them to survive because they can distinguish
the types of snow they need to distinguish in order to go on living in that environment. And that if they didn't, they might perish, etc. And I mean, it could be that they're, well, how should I put it? This sounds question begging, but it could be that there really are that many different varieties of snow, and because of our own needs, we haven't bothered to distinguish them. I mean, we just sort of lump them all together. Our experience isn't that precise or discriminatory.
Aren't you trying to say this, that even though both deductive and inductive reasoning, there is an element of faith and logic are in each one, but so that to use the theological word faith, we have to to the conclusion to accept by faith certain elements, because if you that I cannot be proved absolutely, so therefore we by mutual agreement come to, and we call this mutual agreement faith. We accept this because of the overwhelming evidence as such that this is the way it should be, and so we accept these things as a vehicle whereby we're going to communicate. In other words, that even though we are not absolutely sure of these things, we have to act as though they are for the purpose of communicating.
Yeah, I accept that. If I could back up a little bit, I think I would use the in the context of the two positions I've discussed on Tuesday and today, would use the word faith to refer to one's idea that certain objects which transcend one's immediate experience, say sensory experience, that these objects do exist. I'm here now, the philosopher's characteristic of hedging comes in. I probably wouldn't even say that, but because I mean that, well, let me take an example. On an evening when you look at a sunset and it's a blazing red sunset, it's possible for a physicist to say, well, you know that that's only an apparent color. The real color of the sun is something like it, or is more closer to the color that you see at noon, that sort of yellowish color, if you wish, or whitish, whatever you want to call it, than this reddish color that you see at sunset, because by that time, the certain particles in the atmosphere have radically affected the light waves, and so it looks red, but it isn't, quote, really red. Now, if that's what you mean, I mean, that's not, I say, what I meant by transcendent, the sense in which the real color of the sun transcends the color that you see at sunset. But rather, I was talking about, to take the, I suppose, most obvious example, something like the existence of God or something, in which, at least for many people, they have never literally experienced God. Now here one gets on very shaky psychological grounds, because I'm not sure what one can do if a person just comes up and says, well, I have experienced God. I mean, if you can come up with any arguments that it's literally impossible to do so, or what? I mean, you can't deny, I mean, if a man says, I have a toothache, there's nothing you can do about that particular. I mean, if he continues to insist that he has the toothache, all you can do is accept that as a piece of evidence about the way the world is. And I suppose if a man says he has a certain feeling, that too is a certain piece of evidence about the way the world is. But how you're going to interpret that feeling, namely that it somehow was caused by God as opposed to caused by too much supper or whatever, is a very serious and difficult problem, it seems to me. But in the case of our use of language, it seems to me that we do start not so much on faith in that sense, but just with our common experience. I mean, the attention to the way in which we learn a language, for example, in much of contemporary scholarship, not only philosophy but in many areas, tends to work against a rather extreme relativism in which you say each individual, has his own values, and what's right for one man may be wrong for another man. Because a child does learn a language in a social context. He imitates what he hears other people saying and how he sees them writing and so on. And in this very way, picks up something that's already there and that is already very highly constituted, very complex to begin with an elaborate set of rules and so on. So that this common language, including its supposedly common evaluations, in which, as I said, both people who desire and those who detest apples can agree on what it is to be a good apple. I mean, even in that context, the child would seem to pick up certain things from his common experience and not on what at least I would call faith, but probably all I'm doing is just trying to, in effect, ask you how you're using faith or to say how I'm using it so that we can get on.
In a simplistic sense, the way I'm using faith is by a general acceptance of what is, or by coming to a mutual agreement as to what we want to use. Mm-hmm. Like, for instance, we use the word chair, or the word animal, or the word deer. We've come to a place by mutual agreement. That if it meets certain criteria, then this is what it is. And so I think in relation, this is what the thing of reference that I'm using faith.
Mm-hmm.
Or am I clear as not?
Yeah, I think that's okay. I mean, we.
I wonder whether in this process we don't have to unlearn some things too, just as the child has to. Maybe really unlearn is something you forget and eliminate from my definition. You say that, and maybe it's hearing somebody say, "I experienced God," you can't tell whether it's a suggestion. But at some point, this man has to. Maybe find out what the suggestion is to find out that that's not God. Mm-hmm. Not his religious experience. And the child learns the language the same way by eliminating certain sounds from his liturgical. So it's not just defining something in terms of what it is, but also eliminating
it. Yeah.
Well, on that line, it's always been, it seems to me it's easy in historic, I guess it has been, to say what God isn't.
Right.
You know, Boethius and so forth.
Negative theology.
What God isn't. But it's always been very difficult to say what God is.
Well, yeah, and the reason...
And every name and every predicate that's used for God, Father or, you know, kind shepherd or whatever, it always ends up that the negative... definition of that term is as important as the positive. You know, like you said the other day, when I say God is a father, I hope I don't mean that God is as petulant with his children as I often am with mine. Or maybe I'm afraid that he is. But to give a positive content seems to me to be more difficult. We know God isn't a tummy ache, as she says.
Right. Yeah, and the reason for that, I suppose, is that these words have gotten their initial meaning from human context, and then we try to take them outside that context and apply them to something like God. They just seem to get all warped or stretched out of shape, as I said Tuesday or something. But even if we go back in a sense, get away from if I could, but the God case for a moment, and back to the ethical case. I mean, our experience. Well, how should I put it? I suppose one danger with this system I've outlined this morning is that it perhaps finds it difficult to allow for the phenomenon of the prophet, which is, I think, a case of what Avis was talking about as unlearning or something. I mean, where a general society has conventions already set up, and this, of course, you can see time after time after time in the Old Testament, but then where one individual, one voice crying in the wilderness, whatever you want, comes up, and suddenly starts using the same words in a new way. Where before people said, you know, it was good to somehow accommodate yourself to your neighbors and to perhaps check into their religious beliefs and so on, and Baal started creeping in. Suddenly a prophet comes along and says, the very thing that people are calling good is bad. And then the language, it seems, has to go through, or at least the society has to go through a period of of sorting out, again, the criteria in terms of which they're going to use these words. And this is the very thing that, of course, is existing in our country right now. Some people will say, as I gather was just said last hour, something, sex education is good, and others will say it's bad. Some will say the war in Vietnam is good for, again, certain reasons. I mean, it has to be very carefully spelled out, but in looking at it generically for a moment, some will say it's good and some will say it's bad. And one of the real problems, it seems to me here, is trying to find some sort of common framework in terms of which the discussion can occur. So it's not like one man saying 7-Up refreshes and another man saying no, it doesn't, where they're not even talking on the same basis. I mean, sure, they're both talking about a fluid that came out of one and the same bottle, but they're not saying the same thing about it at all, even though it appears that they are. That's a misleading appearance.
Where do these misleading appearances get us in trouble? The reason I ask that question is when we converse with one another, most of us subjectively understand that they're talking about the same thing but have different opinions. It's not as though it's misleading.
Mm-hmm.
And as soon as the responses tend to mislead, then we have a danger.
We have to find
a framework, okay? But when we don't have anybody being misled, what difference does it make?
Well, I suppose the difference, at least from the point of view of philosophers, is the question whether or not, given, say, two frameworks, whether or not both of these people could eventually find one that they could all agree upon. I mean, let me go back.
Does philosophy look for greater certainty? Is that what you're saying?
Partly, yeah. I mean, let's go back to my, perhaps the headhunters and Quakers example would be a good one. Each having separate criteria of what it is to be a good human being. Now the question it seems to me before us this morning is, does it even make sense, or one question that you're bringing up, I guess, does it make sense to go on to ask, or to say something like, the criteria that the Quakers have is better than the criteria that the headhunters have, or can we only make factual statements and say, well, they've got this criteria, and they've got that criteria, and here they are, you know. And fortunately, those live in New Guinea and these live in Pennsylvania.
Well, isn't that what the situation ethics type of thing that's rather prevalent now? Their ideas of that situation is right, and that's Pennsylvania, that situation is correct.
Right, except they go even one step further and bring it down to the individual. I'm still at least at the level of this morning, at least, of social groupings, whereas they want to say what one person or a couple of persons in a situation think is right is right.
Well, couldn't you say, put the question another way, it's whether or not there are any values that are common to all humanity? That doesn't make sense, but is there a large enough community called humanity, you know, that we can say there are some things that are always recognized or commonly recognized in that largest of all human communities, namely the human community itself?
I suppose, yeah. I mean, and this question usually is thought to have been answered definitely in the negative by anthropologists who have not found very much. But I mean, all they've come up with is perhaps a sort of universal incest taboo and perhaps a prohibition against killing. I mean, even the New Guinea headhunters have a prohibition against killing members of their own tribe.
Do you know this Robert Redfield's book, The Primitive World and Its Transformations? Redfield went down to worked among the Yucatan Indians, and he lived there a long time. And he went with Ruth Benedict's set of assumptions, namely that the total culture relativism, as in for inevitable patterns of culture. But after he was there a while, he heard this story about an Indian peddler, Sharu, who had lived there 100 years before he had come. And peddler Sharu had lived amongst an Indian tribe, a subgroup of these Indians in Yucatan, who had always practiced torture and had always held that manliness was defined as standing up against the torture. And the story about Peddler Sharu went that one day when he became chief and he inherited his father's mantle, he said, "We're going to stop torturing the people we believe to be the best to prove that they're the best." And the tribe, in other words, he was a prophet. The tribe went through a terrible upheaval, but out of it all, they stopped torturing to prove manhood, see?
Mm-hmm.
And Redfield's point is that any man who came to that tribe, Redfield argues as an anthropologist and as a heretofore cultural relativist, would say, in some sense, what Peddler Sharu did was a noble thing. That is, that story that he had heard there he says, made him sort of chuck his cultural relativism in favor of some kind of vague understanding that there are some human things that anybody recognizes. Now, that's an a priori judgment when Redfield says that anyone will recognize it.
Right.
But he wants to say that even these people who were most adamantly opposed to it at the beginning saw it in the end, that manhood isn't tested by the affliction and the
deception. Well, this seems to me to be the same problem that we get with the Alice in the case, you know, she saw nobody on the road. I mean, we use one word, man or humanity or something, and we tend to think that we're just talking about one thing. And it seems to me at least a serious question as to whether or not we are either in different places at the same time or in the same place at different times. I mean, it could be, for instance, that the miners who inhabited this village 3 or 4 decades ago had a quite different set of criteria about what it is to be a person than the people who inhabit it now. And so,
well, do you think there's any way out of that? I get that's what you're asking, I'm saying.
Well, I'm not sure. I think that maybe we have to realize that. Well, the one thing that strikes me out of the position I've discussed this morning is the notion that perhaps good and evil are not definable in isolation, such that there is something called goodness which you can get at, which is the same everywhere in the way in which redness might be. I mean, you can define red in isolation without talking about red apples or red shirts or red cars. But it could be that you can't define good in isolation. You have to talk about good apples or good men or something. And if that's the case, then it would seem that the meaning of the word, at least, and the values would be limited to a certain context. And then I suppose it becomes a practical question as to whether or not you can get everybody to brought into the same context, United Nations or whatever you want to call it. I mean, you know, the whole world somehow accepting the same set of assumptions. At least empirically, it seems difficult, if not impossible.
Well, doesn't this all still hinge on communication?
Yeah.
And that as communication broadens, it's more possible to develop a more common definition? Because every definition in its own context has somehow been communicated.
Mm-hmm.
And when you make the context more common, then you make the definition more common. Or make it possible to have a more common definition.
Mm-hmm.
Isn't that sort of happening? And this is part of the problem that happens with this different geographical and cultural areas are exposed to this common denominator of communication that causes upheaval.
But the funny, the funny thing is that even already in the world in which we live, it's possible for Russians and Americans or for blacks and whites to communicate quite readily about and agree about, say, the facts of nuclear physics. But the same thing isn't the case with values, even though the communication network is already there and the words go back and forth.
Because that's an assumption, the communication network is there.
Well,
you're assuming you communicate along the same lines on scientific principles as you can about philosophical principles.
And that's, and that's the question.
That's a dangerous assumption to make.
I think still the context in which the communication comes hasn't yet reached the state where it's the same. Some things are the same. I think that now we can assume that much more readily that neither Russia or the United States is going to push it. Send the first bomber than it could 20 years ago. Perhaps there could be a change in, well, there has been a change in the world as a whole to kind of.
Well, that I suppose that might be the common denominator, namely that we all have a certain, even if limited, core of needs or interests or something of that sort. Even if these just be food, clothing, and shelter. And that's where. In a sense, ethics really moves in saying that these are what are valuable and have to be accommodated or something.
Yeah, no matter who a man is, Dave, if he's coughing and someone gets him a glass of water, the man, in some way or other, has to say that was a good glass of water, doesn't he?
Right.
If it stops the coughing. Or if someone's got a broken arm and he fixes it, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, cannot That isn't to say that like in what's this novel by Cronin, about the doctor that goes to the priest that goes to China and cauterizes a child's wound and the child gets better. And the medicine men at first say, you know, that's terrible what he's doing. Look, he's burning the flesh and so forth. But in the end, when the flesh is healed, the people in the village recognize that this priest, who's had a little bit of medical training, that this priest did a good thing. You know. I mean, are there basic human needs, the meaning of which offer in the human community as a whole some kind of concept of what it means, what good means? A cup of cold water is a biblical metaphor.
I know I can get to wondering sometimes where the undertaker figures you did a good thing, bringing a guy back to life when he just lost his was that a good thing, you know, after all the death has already been? If once it's been established, there should be nobody come in and say you can bring it back to life. The undertaker's already looking for his... He's got the cash register working.
But of course, that again is a very narrow, conventional interest, as opposed to a general human interest.
I get prejudiced sometimes.
No, I think you're right.
On that question that you asked, doesn't that depend on the person? The person may be suspicious of why he brought that cup of water from that cup. Are you trying to win me over to do something else, or are you doing it out of a real...
Or maybe the type of person who feels indication of weakness to take water from somebody else, you'd rather cough it out for 10 minutes than even drink water. Mm-hmm. And this, if you want to characterize the Russian attitude, maybe that's one way to do it. They would rather struggle along on their own theories of genetics, Christian, whatever it may be, than learn something from somebody else. Or Americans, maybe this is what I said. Maybe we would rather do it this way: and receive a cup of water. And I think this ability to receive, I think, as we've been hearing for 2 weeks now, is part of the problem that I think goes directly to what we're talking about this morning.
Right.
Or like as is often claimed that youth do not want to be taught; they want to learn themselves. It's the same thing. They don't want to receive the knowledge. They want to grope for it.
They want to make the same
mistakes. Make their own mistakes.
They made for 2,000 years.
It's a lot of mistakes to make.
But of course, there's one thing in what you said about the cup of cold water that I think ought to be discussed further. Maybe we can get at it next week or some other time over coffee. And that is that, at least as I see it, there seems to be a very tenuous relationship between what motivates an action and whether or not that action is right or wrong. I mean, there seem to be other criteria for evaluating the action than whether or not the man had his heart in the right place. Well, because it seems to be that if a person is well-intentioned and simultaneously stupid, he can do a lot of harm in the world.
Mm-hmm. I think that's where divine sense takes over from human sense. And there's a difference.
How do you...
When God starts to take action through a person, then when the person just makes his own judgments at a very fast, instantaneous given time.
How do you know?
How can we?
You don't know. Except to have the faith that God can work through man to make a quick decision.
Well, we all, of course, hope that
that's
the case.
And that's beyond the senses perception.
We hope that that's the case, but see, when we're confronted with a specific instance, then we've got to say with that man or God.
Understand. Let's get beyond the hope. When we take faith, we're beyond the hope. Let's maybe take another step beyond the faith. Let's try to understand more about God's working all the time. And then we don't have to judge. I wonder if that guy took the right step or not when he pulled that child out of the, or picked him up. Oh, hey, you aren't supposed to pick up the injured. After all, you can break the backbone. So therefore, we don't touch the injured. So therefore, the undertaker comes and takes him away. It was too late. They had no way of saving because you shouldn't pick up anybody when they've been injured. Well, how do you use that decision? Let's have a little bit more.
Now, you think there's a way of finding out which acts are God's?
We've got to be knowing every moment of our existence. That's the reason we're here.
I was wondering how we did that.
What?
How do we do that?
Working through thinking about what we're here for, and that's to demonstrate the highest of thinking. Of intelligence, and there's only one intelligence for my way, and that's God.
Well, then, to take that corollary, do you think that every act is God?
No.
Then we've got a dilemma.
But sometimes the instantaneous decision has to be made.
And you, yeah, but then it seems to me that then it's not improper to say, I hope that what I did was God-inspired.
Yeah,
I say, yeah.
Yeah, otherwise you're in danger of becoming very dogmatic.
Yeah.
God is always working for me.
Right, you're right. Yes.
Well, as a matter of fact, now that I think about that,
yeah.
I'm a little bit,
Well, it's about 10:15, maybe we can, coffee pot should be on.